after years of doing what I did in neurosurgery, I did want to bring to readers what that world is like, because it's a crazy world. It's a world very foreign to most people, what it's really like behind the swinging doors to the OR, and what goes on during an operation, and what goes on in the ICUs and the ERs from the doctor's side of the fence, and what the conversations are like, what the decision-making's like, what causes anxiety, what causes a sense of fulfillment, all that sort of stuff. I kind of all along thought, I mean, people would probably be interested in this stuff because it's pretty wild and woolly at times.
You are now listening to the podcast where authors inspire listeners to become authors, the Going North Podcast. I'm your host, certified self-leadership trainer, best-selling author, and book enthusiast, Dom Brightman. And you're going to be listening to a different author that will inspire you to join the business of immortality, known as authorship. Now let the fun begin. Today's episode is sponsored by the brand new Northbound to Your Success shop, where you can buy the wonderful logo, Advance Others to Advance Yourself, in t-shirt form, mug form, heck, even a phone case if you like a phone case. Either way, click on shop on goingnorthpodcast.com, cop a t-shirt, hoodie or two, and be sure to tag the host when you do, so that way I can give you a shout out on a future episode of the podcast. Now let's get down to business with the episode for real. And today on the Highlight Reel Builder for Authors, known as the Going North Podcast, we got another super special, awesome human for you today, courtesy of one of the best websites on planet Earth today, known as podmatch.com, the wonderful site where podcast guests get to connect with podcast hosts. And if they're cool, they're freaking in. And today's guest is cooler than three cucumbers indeed, because we got one heck of a special guest for you today, because this might be a first for the show, my friends, because today's guest is a neurosurgeon as well as a professor and a public speaker. So let's give it up for the generous and stupendous, the fabulous Dr. Gary Simmons. How you doing today, Dr. Gary?
Well, I'm feeling much better now after that introduction. You know, I may have been dragging a little bit, but now I'm all pumped.
Ooh, sweet. I'm glad I can be the air pump to your tire, my friend.
Well, I need more of you around. That's all I can say.
That's right, indeed. I guess that was a pun unintended, huh? Round like the records and the tires, but hey, they just about records, even though you're probably breaking them somewhere in someone's book. And I'm pretty sure I forgot a whole bunch of stuff in the introduction, since they're not allowed to be 8,000 days long. So am I filling in any cavities I may have missed about you?
No, that sounds great. Again, it did my ego good.
Oh, man. Well, the thing is, I noticed doing a little past research about you, is like, my man used to work in DC, like like for one of the most famous hospitals in the whole country, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yep, I was at Walter Reed for quite a while there in DC. Now I mean that was in another century, and I guess you could say another millennium. It's been a while, but yeah, I spent a lot of time in DC. Unfortunately, I didn't see a lot of it because was pretty much in the hospital most of the time.
There you go. So indeed, being hospitable, I imagine.
I hope. Or being patient with the patients, right?
There you go. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because definitely indeed, that's right indeed. So my goodness, what would you consider your three major leadership lessons gained from the good old, wonderful surgery room, my man? Because my man being a neurosurgeon, like helping out kids and I imagine adults too with the brain, like that's definitely delicate work, man. So what would you consider your three major leadership lessons gained from your time there, man?
Well, I would say one of my key things in leadership is lead by example. That could definitely take its toll because if you're always trying to set an example, it does set a high bar. But I think it's really important that you don't just go around telling people what they should be doing and then they see you doing something completely opposite. So I always did try to do what I preached. I think another one, frankly, is to accept and really focus in on what we would call mentors, people who are brighter than you, people who have been around the block longer than you, people who really seem to have it together and know what they're doing. And I was kind of fiercely independent. And I had all this opportunity, particularly in the military, of having amazing people around me all the time. And I wish I actually took much more advantage of that. You know, you have, and it doesn't have to be the military, it can be any setting, but we always have amazing people around us. And I think if we get too self-focused and narcissistic, we forget how much we can learn from others and then hopefully contribute to others as well. And then I think you wanted three, so I'll come up with the third one. But I think a good leader really, more than anything, promotes the people that they're leading. In other words, projects them, puts them out there, gets the accolades for them rather than for yourself. Hopefully you get your satisfaction from seeing the people that you're taking care of, that you're leading, accomplishing great things instead of kind of jealously trying to scoop up all the accolades for yourself. I think it's really important to promote those theoretically under you.
Oh yeah, definitely. Certain days, especially all the wonderful colleagues and nurses and such, heck, maybe even some interns wanting to learn from you. And with you being a professor too, I'm sure you give them all sorts of wonderful knowledge.
Well, I hope. They certainly get their share of me. Well, hopefully some of it is worthwhile, and then hopefully some of it sticks.
There you go. That's right, indeed. Hopefully bigger than twigs, too.
Well, sometimes it feels like you have to hit them with a big stick, but no. No, you know, I got to tell you, Dom, I'm old, and people in my generation, they're always complaining about, you know, the youth, and they're lazy and they're snowflakes and they were brought up on gaming and on their cell phones all the time. Well, I hold the opposite opinion. It's, to me, the people that I've worked with, the kids from, you know, the today's youth, they're just amazing, and I have no fears for the future when I see who's coming up and through the ranks. So even though I may joke that I have to beat them with the stick, the reality is they probably have to beat me with the stick more.
I guess when it comes to slang and other new technology, I'm guessing.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's like night and day when one of them gets on a computer or any sort of technology. Just hooking up the wires for a lecture can be a major journey.
Heck, indeed. So did you ever see yourself becoming a professor?
I guess I always very much enjoyed teaching. And so it just kind of came naturally. I mean, there are so many learners around on so many levels, nursing students, PA students, therapy students, all sorts of medical students, undergrads wanting to go to medical school. I mean, we have residents, you know, neurosurgery residents who were teaching to be neurosurgeons. It's kind of nonstop. So it becomes, I think, pretty easy to switch into the teaching mode. I also think, you know, if you're going to be a good doc, I think you have to be a good teacher, period, in that I think every patient you deal with, it's your duty to kind of teach them about what's going on with their bodies. And a lot of people don't come in with a lot of knowledge about it. Unfortunately, one of the downsides of our electronic and information era is they often come in with bad information. You know, they've hit some website and the website's not very good. And you know, they may come in with all of these sort of misperceptions and misconceptions. So I think every single patient you deal with, it's your duty as a physician to really teach them as much as you can about what their situation is, what their options are, try to give them a set of options, but hopefully give them some guidance and what you think might be the best options. And then, you know, ultimately have them be the decision makers. But it's hard to have them be decision makers if they're not brought up to snuff on, you know, what the scene is about what they've got, what's going on, and what potential treatments there are available.
That's what I'm talking about indeed. Because, yeah, it's like the running joke on some it's a meme online where you go to a certain site and you look up one thing. It's like, oh, man, I'm sneezing. And it's like, go to the website, you're going to die. It's like, wait, yeah. What?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there is crazy stuff out there for sure. And boy, in today's political climate, it's like you can basically say anything and it doesn't seem like there's any repercussions. And yeah, there's so much misinformation out there. But even, you know, even if the information is good, how is somebody who hasn't gone through all the schooling really going to sort it out without a lot of help?
Sure, indeed, because, hey, all that past information may be useful, but it's like, hey, it's not coming from an actual doctor in real time when your situation might not be as bad as is being portrayed online.
Right, right. And, yeah, there can be some real horror shows portrayed out there.
Yeah, exactly. You just wake up one day and you got a dolphin fin coming out of your ear and you're like, what the heck happens? And it's like, oh, you just should have put down the weed. That's all, buddy.
Well, that may be the solution often, but who knows?
So my goodness. So all that wonderful experience with educating the masses and the molasses, you decided to join the business of immortality by writing a book, my man. That's right indeed. A wonderful thriller, Death's Pale Flag. So what led you to write this book, my man?
Well, I'm not sure how much immortality I'll get out of it. I it's an interesting process, I have to say. I have written three other books, but they were all nonfiction. And then, of course, in medicine, you write journal articles and science stuff and research stuff and all that sort of thing. But, you know, to a certain degree, it always felt more like a chore to me, in that it's almost like a book report. And I never liked writing book reports. You know, it just, after a while, it kind of felt like drudgery. And I've always enjoyed writing fiction, never had a lot of time to do it, but would write short pieces or pieces, you know, a few paragraphs here or there. But it's interesting if you actually kind of sit down and start doing it, particularly after being in that fact-based world, because all of a sudden it's like the world is blown open. I mean, you can go anywhere, you can take it in any direction, you can have stuff that happens that would never happen, you know, in real life, as far as we know. So it was crazy. It felt like such a release to be able to just let the stories go and kind of take them where I wanted. Now, I guess that doesn't really answer your question, how did I end up doing it or why did I end up doing it? After years of doing what I did in neurosurgery, I did want to bring to readers what that world is like, because it's a crazy world. It's a world very foreign to most people. What it's really like behind the swinging doors to the OR, and what goes on during an operation, and what goes on in the ICUs and the ERs from the doctor's side of the fence, and what the conversations are like, what the decision-making's like, what causes anxiety, what causes a sense of fulfillment, all that sort of stuff. I kind of all along thought, I mean, people would probably be interested in this stuff, because it's pretty wild and woolly at times. So I had considered, writing another nonfiction. And as I said, I was getting tired of the book reports. So I decided, well, maybe if I did it as a fiction, it might even be more interesting for the reader, more put them in the scene, have them at the head of the table with a head that's opened up, have the brain bleeding, and having them try to figure out, well, how the heck would I stop that? And that's kind of what I wanted to do. And then I had to figure out, well, how do I make it into a some sort of compelling fiction? And originally, it was a totally different story. It was actually a neurosurgeon at Walter Reed who started getting members of government in with dreadful aneurysms of the brain. And the neurosurgeon begins to suspect that somehow this is being caused by something, eventually figuring out that maybe it's some sort of toxin, some sort of poison that somebody's going after members of government with. And there was going to be a beautiful blonde FBI agent, you know, who, you know, he worked with and probably fell in love with. Anyway, it didn't work. I couldn't get it, you know, to read well. So I completely switched horses and began thinking about the fact that, you know, in my world, we deal with a lot of life and death, and we deal with, frankly, a lot of death. And a lot of people who end up dying, a few people that hopefully we save from dying. But I started thinking about, well, that world of death and the world of the living and how close we were to the border zone all the time. And whether, you know, if there were such thing as ghosts, whether they might see a surgeon, a neurosurgeon, as somebody familiar, somebody that seems to be hanging around a lot, and maybe easier to kind of reach out to or touch or interface with closeness to the world of death and maybe the undead. And so in the story, this brain surgeon begins to see ghosts. He initially thinks they're hallucinations, but eventually convinces himself that they were real living people from his area. Some turn out to be his former patients, and he begins to believe that they are very real. You as the reader have to decide, are they real or is he losing his mind? So that's kind of where the story revolves around. But it, you know, it gets more and more worse, basically, and we have to see where it leads.
That's right indeed. Right. That's why man had to move to North Carolina. Let me get away from these ghosts. Let me stop. I'll be in the North Carolina mountains. Give me some peace and quiet.
Yeah, I haven't seen many ghosts here yet, but I'm sure they are around.
That's what I'm talking about, indeed. It's kind of interesting, too, how you had to really switch gears for that and really change the theme. But it sounds like it came out even better than what originally was going to be, too. So, my goodness, how was it like with that changing of the gears in a way, having to jump away from the book reports? And even though it's probably a lot more interesting, like was it like a huge learning curve at first for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had no idea what the heck I was doing. So I read a whole bunch of books on how to write fiction. I guess that's a kind of a typical, you know, MD reaction to the situation. You read up, because that's all we ever did in our, you know, in our professional lives, is you're just constantly reading up on the latest things. And obviously in med school, all you did was study and, you know, all that stuff. But that's how I approached it. I tried to, you know, kind of teach myself, listened to podcasts, watched a bunch of, you know, YouTube type videos. And it's very much a learning experience. I found the actual writing part for me was easy. In fact, it was, I call it, you know, kind of like a verbal dysentery. I originally the book was, you know, it's like 250,000 words, which is Stephen King length, you know, and I realized nobody's going to read, you know, they'll read Stephen King at that length, but they're not going to read Gary Simmons at that length. So I literally pretty much hacked out a book and a half. So it came down to 100,000 words, I think. And that was one of the things you learned first is you got to be willing to, you know, kind of hack your baby to death because it starts to feel like your baby, you know, when you've written all this stuff, but you got to kind of rewrite. I did go ahead and ask a couple of what they call developmental editors before I even brought it to publishers. I asked developmental editors to go through the book and, you know, got a lot of great recommendations from them on how to tighten it up and how a lot of stuff was unnecessary and maybe I was going in too many directions and too many characters and stuff like that. And that was really useful because it really, I feel like I really tightened up the story and didn't necessarily have to explain everything and every detail of everything and let the reader's imaginations fill in, you know, a lot of stuff. So yeah, it was a huge learning experience, but it was, I'll tell you, it was fun as hell. I mean, I can't say that I've enjoyed things ever as much as I was doing that. And I've enjoyed a lot of things in life, but it was really, I would sit down sometimes, you know, to write. And then I would look up and it was 6 hours later. And I was like, oh my God, I haven't moved. I'm, you know, I'm going to get blood clots in my legs if I don't get up and start moving. And I better, you know, tell my wife I'm still alive and stuff like that. But incredibly enjoyable.
That's what I'm talking about indeed. And the good news is, I guess that process is why you won awards for the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Nobel Prize Committee hasn't got to me yet. So, it's been nicely received. I have to say, I'm really, really pleasantly surprised because you know, you just don't know. But there's been a lot of nice reviews and compliments and that sort of thing. I'll tell you, there's an interesting side to that though. The ending of the book has been the most controversial thing about it. And a couple of the editors, you know, they said, do you really want to end that way? And I was like, well, I do, but I, you know, then I had my wife weigh in, had some other people I trust a lot weigh in and they all liked the ending. So far, you know, as people, I give talks to book clubs and stuff like that. And I would say, you know, about 50% of people kind of go, why'd you end it that way? And about 50% go, I love that ending. It was, you know, a great ending. And to me, that's a success. If it's controversial, I kind of feel like that's a success. I want people thinking and talking. And that was another interesting thing I learned about it. And I learned about the process is when you write nonfiction, when you write your book reports, there's not a lot of opinions going on. There's not a lot of people going, well, I you shouldn't have ended it that way. I ended that way because that's the way it works. But with fiction, people said, and I can't remember whose original quote it is, but you know, I remember reading in one of my how-to books that when you finally release your book, when you let it go, it's out of your hands, it's not your book anymore. You have your own theory, your own philosophy on what you're trying to do with the book and maybe where you're trying to lead the reader. But once the readers have it, it's their decision where it leads. And it's really interesting then to hear people's theories on, you know, well, I believe this, I believe the guy should have been doing this, or the wife should have been doing this, or the ghosts are doing that. I all sorts of different viewpoints, some of which then you start thinking, geez, I wonder if that was going on in my subconscious, because that's pretty cool. I like that take on it. So it's really, I think one of the most fun parts about it is when the people start coming back at you and giving you their opinions on what you were doing with the book. And I think if you keep an open mind to that, A, it's a lot of fun. And B, it kind of gives you, starts giving you ideas for other books because, you know, they, people are smart. They come up with some really interesting insights.
Interesting insights indeed. And that's beautiful right there, because you're so right. Because like once you put the book out there, unless you, and it's going to take some time to make another edition if you so choose, probably less of a chance for a thriller, but still, it's like once it's out there, it's like, yep, it ain't yours anymore. And there's going to be some folks like, yeah, it's best book ever. Some folks be like, yeah, man, 3 stars. And it's like, oh, some like, oh God, why'd you kill everybody?
Yeah, I one example of in the book, it's about, of course, a neurosurgeon. They say write what you know about, so that's what I wrote about first. Actually, I wrote another book first, a young adult book about a soccer player, but that was in rewrites, and I just kept getting the bug to get this book on, so I put that on hold and went to this one. But anyway, in this book, it's about a neurosurgeon who begins to see ghosts, but his wife plays an important part, and there's a fair amount of marital strain in it. But I thought I was making the wife, you know, super sympathetic and just a really good person. And most of the people read it that way, but some people have come, you know, to me and said, you know, I loved the surgeon, I hated the wife. And I was like, yeah. Really? How did you come up with that? But it's, again, it's not for me to say, you know, it's, they're making their calls on the characters in the book, which is really interesting and kind of exciting. It gives them a different life, you know, it gives them a new life.
Oh, say that again, indeed. Definitely say that again, indeed. Because that's the beauty of a book. It's like, hey, you take them to fantasy world, and it's like, oh, they just build their own world with that world. It's like, oh, it's freaking huge. And they probably get some wonderful details in it through their mind that you didn't even expect. And it just comes out. It's like, oh, makes it even a better experience for them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we always have to remember that everybody comes to life from different angles, right? We're all from different backgrounds. We all have, you know, different experiences from when we were in the womb all the way through, right? You know, all the way and growing up, and our cultures, our people, our schooling, our experiences, they're all different. And that's going to affect us. In fact, you know, if you get into the neuroscience of it all, you know, just how we interpret reality, how our brains process reality is probably fairly different from person to person, even though there are grand kind of overarching ways our brains work. All our brains are different. And so it shouldn't come as a shock, I guess, when people experience a book differently. And again, then it becomes super interesting. I love hearing other people's interpretations of it. So that's one of the things I ask for people to do is, please give me feedback on it. Tell me what you thought. Tell me what you thought of, you know, the plot, the ghost, the people, the various characters, that sort of thing. The one thing that I wanted to come through too, that I think was more consistent and hopefully, you know, really comes through, is one of the things I wanted to get across in the book on the more realistic side of it was just how freaking brave and full of grace most of the patients, almost all the patients and their families are in these horrible situations that I portray. Because, you know, there's no sugarcoating going on. What's happening to good people or happening to people in general in the books is horrible, because that's what we saw. You know, every time you see the helicopter come into a hospital, it's bringing some disaster. And, you know, somebody's life, some family's life has been turned totally upside down. And they come in with the most horrible things, you know, brain tumors, aneurysms, paralysis, coma, you know, one thing after another, after another. And I worked in these big trauma centers. So in the middle of the night, you know, you could see 10, 20 absolute disasters. And, you know, and then you're going and talking to the families all that. And I will tell you, almost to a person, it never ceased to shock me how, as I said, brave and full of grace the people, the patients and their families were. Just, you know, that was the thing that got me out of bed every morning, was, you know, dealing and trying to help people like that. Because again, we're in a society right now that just seems to be we're at each other's throats for whatever reason. But you get into that scenario and the true strength of, you know, human beings and the true grace of human beings just invariably came out. And it was a great inspiration. So I hoped to get that into the book as well. I wanted kind of the horror of it all, and then, you know, the ghost side of it all, but I wanted to get how brave and full of grace these patients and their families are.
That's what I'm talking about, indeed. So, my goodness, so is there a question that you wish folks would ask you more often when you're doing interviews like these?
Yeah, well, you know, I always want them to ask why I wasn't Brad Pitt's double, you know, in Hollywood. And but that question doesn't come up very much, so I have to think of other things. I am always happy to and willing to talk about just the whole experience of on so many levels, but of what that world was like. And what I really got into, and this book certainly hovers around it, and the other books are specifically about it, but it is also about the toll that it takes on the caregivers. And certainly in this book, it's really focused on the surgeon. But the reality is, I think everybody in the healthcare world faces a huge amount of stress. And it just seems to ratchet up every year. We demand more and more of everybody in the healthcare systems. I think a huge amount of weight, for example, is placed on our nurses. And I, you know, it's interesting because people will ask me and they'll say, gee, it must have been at its worst during COVID. And I say, you know, during the worst years of the pandemic. And I often will say, you know, yeah, there was some of that. But I think during the pandemic, what happens is like being at war. I think everybody just kind of geared up and just said, okay, this is gonna be rough. It's gonna be bad. It's gonna beat us up, but we got to get it done. So, you know, they just kind of lowered their head and drove. And then as it kind of started to go away and settled down, at least, it hasn't gone away, obviously, but it settled down and we're safer and all that. And we don't have thousands of people dying every day from it. I think a lot of people in the healthcare started looking around and going, wait a minute, we went to heroic levels to get this under control and nothing has changed. We're not being treated better. We're not getting more break time. We're not getting more time off. We're not getting paid more, you know, particularly if you look at the nurses and the nurses' aides and the medical assistants and all the people who support the mission. Nothing really changed. And I think the burnout is even worse now than during the pandemic. I think people are feeling that strain now more than the pandemic. So to answer your question, you know, I always appreciate it when people want to talk about the stress, the psychological strain placed on caregivers and, you know, not just physicians. This is not a physician only thing. It's everybody in the business. But I do think physicians are there too, feeling the strain. And, you know, I also think it's not just in medicine. I think all of us in society, I wonder about some of this incivility that we're showing each other right now is more a symptom of burnout. It's interesting in the healthcare world. One of the ways that we see burnout more than a lot of other ways is kind of anger behavior, being curt, being short, snappy, sarcastic, mean sometimes to one another. And these are good people who are kind of letting loose and every so often having a tantrum and that sort of thing. So it makes me wonder that if you know, we as a society are just exhibiting this right across the board, because we all face this hyper warp speed, if you want, in our lives, and multitasking like crazy, and the phones are going off and the texts are going off, and we got to do 20 things at once, and you know, and there's always financial concern and strain. And so I wonder if, you know, some of how nasty we've been to one another revolves more around our stress level has reached a point where we're all burning out some. So anyway, that's one of the subjects I love to talk about, as you might be able to tell.
And hey, for good reason, like even, I believe one of our past guests, I think it was Jen Godet, when she was, I believe burnout is one of her fields of expertise, because she also came from the physical therapy. That was one of her things in sports medicine, was the fact that a lot of folks in the medical field were burnt out before the pandemic even started. So it's like having that on top of the already burnt out folks. It's like, oh God, what the heck, man? And it's just really a lot of folks just leaving them to just quit and become travel nurses, or maybe jump to a whole another field altogether. And those who remain, it's like kudos to them, because like that's really huge to be able to deal with the burnout beforehand, go through the during phases of the peak of the pandemic, and then now in the somewhat aftermath stage, even though that darn pesky COVID's still out there, is the fact that now people are extra weird and extra and uncivilized than usual. And it's like, oh God, I got people, like people are going to people with us. Like, ah, this is too much peopling. Like, what the heck, man? This was not the contract. I didn't get this in nursing school.
No, exactly. Part of it is it becomes so relentless that, you know, if you can get breaks from things, a lot of times you can chill and recalibrate and reset, but we just keep pushing forward. And as you say, you know, in the nursing realms, a lot all of a sudden had these options to go out and be travelers, or, you know, just to get out of the standard nursing careers. And they did. And I think that, you know, all of a sudden the corporate medicine side of this was going, what the heck's going on? Where are these people going? You mean we actually have to pay people to, you know, to stick around? And I was kind of happy to see them get a little kick in the teeth, if you will, to start treating the nurses better and to appreciate them more. So, you know, during the pandemic, they kind of thought, well, we'll put up some signs around the hospital saying our nurses are healthcare heroes. I don't know if you heard that all the time, but it's healthcare heroes, healthcare heroes. And, you know, the nurses I was talking to were going, you know, the signs don't cut it. You know, what cuts it is give me more time off or give me a raise, and then maybe we can figure out how to deal with this better. But I think there was a rude introduction to the fact that these are not cogs in a piece of machinery that you can just take out and put a new one in. These are highly trained and highly dedicated people. And if you lose them, they ain't easy to replace.
No. It's cheaper to keep them.
It absolutely that's been looked at, and you know, the amount of money it costs to get a new nurse is much cheaper to keep them.
Exactly. And not just from financial perspective, just the time perspective, because it's like you got to train the new folks.
100%.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a lot of things people don't consider sometimes. It's like, oh yeah, we can do it without them, and it's like, oh crap, I don't think we can do it without him. I come back. We were just joshing come back. So my goodness. So speaking of wonderful financial goodness and good old time off, I'm sure there's food involved too with some good old health. And if your wonderful book, Death's Pale Flag, if that book were a food, what would it be and why?
Oh my gosh. If it were a food, it would probably be a heavily laden pizza with all sorts of hot stuff on it, so that you're kind of burning your mouth while you're eating it. And then hopefully it comes back and haunts you some more later on, you know, later in the night, you kind of wake up and you go, ooh, I just absorbed something a lot more intense than I thought I was.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. Indeed. It's like Super Hawaiian Buffalo. Check out pizza. All the spice. That's right. Indeed. Actually, you know what? That I forgot. I think it's a YouTube show. I'm not sure if it's First We Feast or the Hot Wings, or it's where they bring all celebrities. They have to eat these ultra hot, spicy wings before they get to promote their stuff or whatever, and they have to tell stories while they're eating it. So.
I have seen clips of that. It's pretty funny. And yeah, you know, that might be a way to look at it. In other words, I would say it's not necessarily for the weak of heart or stomach, because I get fairly graphic about what happens in the operating rooms. And then hopefully the supernatural side is good and spooky. So one of the things I want people to think about, what's actually scarier, the supernatural world or the natural world, you know, behind the scenes in the hospital there. But right from the very opening scene, you're going to be thrust in the operating room and things are going to be bleeding and, you know, heart monitors are going to be going off and stuff like that.
Yep. Yep. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. So make sure you wear your seatbelt, y'all. That's right indeed.
Wear your seatbelt. I'm sorry to interrupt, but by the way, wear your seatbelt, period. You know, wear it for reading the book. But, you know, if you read the book, one of the things you'll see is that people end up the way they end up sometimes because they forget to do things like that, like wear their seatbelts.
Yep, that's right indeed. I think a couple folks, I think one of them was even a UFC fighter in her early 20s. It's like, oh, rest in peace, this person. I'm like, what the hell? Like, she looks freaking, and like she just went into college. It's like, oh, she was in a car without a seatbelt, and that's how she passed. It's like, oh.
Yeah, Dom, I usually worked in, you know, the East Coast and Mid-Atlantic, I guess, region. And it's seasons, you know, you have seasons. Well, it always seemed like, you know, as soon as May would come around, the car accidents would, you know, the bad car accidents would start really heating up. And we would, you know, once you hit summer in the ICU, we'd have lineups of teenagers in coma, just, you know, several beds along. And almost invariably, they had gone through the windshield. And you can even see some YouTubes of accidents where this happens. I don't recommend it, but I use it for the med students. So they recognize that this is a very real thing of people being shot right through the windshield. And they'll go 30 yards down the highway, bounce 30 yards down the highway. So something like that, or just to where I teach on the Virginia Tech campus, and you see all these kids going by on, I don't know even what they're called anymore, like the hoverboards, you know, or the single wheel or various, or the, you know, stand-up platforms and those sort of things. But half of them aren't wearing helmets. And it is just so easy to fall and do some monumental damage, which would have been protected with the helmets. So another goal I was hoping for the book is just for people to understand just how fragile this all is, and how hopefully we appreciate it. We appreciate the people we care about, the people we love, and we let them know how much we love and care for them, because it is so, so fragile. It doesn't take much at all, you know, to push it into a whole nother world. So whenever we can, we should do our best to protect ourselves and the people we love. But we should also appreciate them and let them know it. There's no point in getting pissed off at each other all the time and barking at each other, because it won't feel good if something bad happens.
I can say that again. That's right indeed. There's dogs and humans for a reason. There's no demons. Like, there's no dog humans out there. Like, don't have to bark at each other all the time. Now, if there's people out there who like to put on dog suits, that's a whole nother category we're not even gonna cover. But hey, no demons out there.
That's their choice.
If you're wearing a dog
more
suit,
power to them.
Yeah, exactly. More power to you. Unleash your inner wolf. If you're wearing a dog suit, listening to this right now, take a selfie. I will be entertained. But anyways, you're coming down to the magical question that every guest gets to receive, and that is, if you don't wake up tomorrow and you're 25 again, but you're still in the current year, what advice would you give to yourself?
I go back to something I already said, so that's kind of boring if I repeat it. But I think of my 25-year-old self, and again, I thought I knew everything. I believed I knew everything, and missed so many opportunities in life just by listening to other people. It could be on a mentor level, but even just listen to people. I think I talk too much. I still do talk too much, and I've always found through the years that if I listen more, I'm a much better person for it. So yeah, I think I would say talk less, listen more, and also, though, explore a lot. Just come to know the world and various people as best you can. Really open up your world to all sorts of different experiences, and particularly people. I think we tend to gather around like people, people who are similar to us. And that makes it all the more easier to see people as being foreign to us. And the reality is, I think the more we interact with people of all kinds of different backgrounds and all, just the better people we become. But we just learn so much more because we're not just in this, you know, echo chamber where we all think the same thing. We're all just repeating the same thing. So yeah, I think that would be the corollary, is open ourselves up to other people and actually listen. Stop talking and listen. And I think we'll be better people for it. I wish I had. I think, you know, I've only learned that in old age.
Well, in today's case, talking is a good thing, my friend.
Yeah, and get off the freaking phones, I would also say. Be careful of getting too sucked into the phones. Nothing beats face-to-face. Nothing beats being around other people. And we're not going to reproduce it on the phone, even if we're texting constantly or IMing or TikToking instantly, you know, all the time. It's not the same. Put the phone down. It's okay to play with it periodically, but yeah, get out there and meet each other, or do it at least by Zoom, where you're truly face-to-face and you're talking.
Heck yeah, indeed. You're so right, indeed. Remember when I first got the smartphones, I think it was like 2016, I finally joined. It's like, wow. So this is why folks are in zombie apocalypse mode with these things. So much crap on there designed to distract you. Next thing you know, 1 minute turned into five, and it's like, what the heck happened?
Well, how are you about it? Are you, what is like your screen time? And do you have it under control, or are you... do you feel like you're getting constantly sucked into it?
Well, I'm better now than what I was before, because I was like, wow. I was like, why are folks so attached to these things in the beginning? It's like, oh, so this is why. But yeah, definitely I'm usually aware of it for the most part. I'm pretty good with the screen time. I'm not stuck on it all day and ignoring everything around me, because, hey, one, you're missing out on life, and two, if you're in public, that's a security risk.
Yeah, for sure. Do you ever have to kind of remind yourself and say, doggone it, put that damn thing down?
Oh, yeah, from time to time, definitely. Definitely. Like, if it's like me in line waiting at a bank, okay, it's like, all right, cool, I'll just pull it out for a little bit and poke my head up every now and then to survey the area, be like, all right, I guess things are still normal. Go back to the email and scrolling and whatnot. But you know, sometimes, yeah, I'm like, I think I'll just go ahead and put this down for a second, because there's so many other things I need to accomplish.
I get sucked into the doom scrolling, you know, where you're constantly reading about all the horrible things that are happening, and I get more and more angry and more sad. And I have to say, wait a minute, you know, again, most people are good people and they want the best for each other. And so just stop reading that stuff.
Yep. You can say that again. Don't make yourself depressed, y'all. It's right indeed. So that means you should read Gary's books instead. So my goodness, so for those who need to keep in contact with you and cop some copies of all your books, what's the best way for folks to do so, Dr. Gary?
I do have a website. It's my name, GaryRSimons.com. And I say Simons, I pronounce it Simmons, but you spell it Simons, S-I-M-O-N-D-S. So it's GaryRSimons.com. And that'll get you right there on a bunch of books, a bunch of written pieces. I do write blogs on Psychology Today, and they're there, and a lot of stuff on burnout. But I also, I try to make it easy to contact me because I really do like it when people want to talk about any of these subjects. And then I have a lot of neuro and healthcare related subjects because I work a lot with med students and pre-meds and try to help out and, you know, make that a tolerable existence as well.
Sweet. Well, you heard that right, folks. Check out the Good Docs website. We're going to put a link to that in the show notes so that way you can get copies of his magical books and read his articles as well, especially on burnout. Indeed, that's right indeed. Because hey, if you're feeling like a candle and you're running out of wax, I'm sure my man's got you covered like a blanket on how to restore your wax, y'all. That's right indeed. That's right indeed.
Yeah, so hopefully we can help on that. And we really do have lots of suggestions on how to help yourself.
Yeah, indeed, because you don't want the flame to turn into a giant, wonderful incandescent ordeal. And it's like, oh, I got no more wax. I'm burning up. And it's like, oh, it's too much. My goodness, any parting words before we close up shop, my man?
The main parting words is thank you so much for having me and let me spout my inanities here, but I really do appreciate it. I'm very beholden to you and honored that you would have me. And this is super fun. It's a great show. Hopefully I'm helping you with your listeners.
If you're listening to this, that means you're one cool individual. If you want to be cooler than two cucumbers, share this episode with someone that you think will enjoy it too. And be sure to subscribe and keep listening.